And welcome back. This is the Northern Miner Podcast on location from downtown Vancouver. I'm your host, Matthew Keeble, alongside... And today we're joined by one of our reoccurring guests, friends of the program, Mickey Fulp, the mercenary geologist. Thanks for joining us, Mickey.
Recurring. That sounds like it's a recurring headache or something like that.
No, it's not negative. It's good. It's good. We like... It's our insight from south of the border, as I call it, from New Mexico specifically.
True. Well, I've been here almost a month.
That's right. Yeah, you've been here for 4 weeks.
It's time to get out of this snowy place and go back where we have snow, but at least the sun shines in between the snows. And you don't get a weather forecast in some shade of gray.
It is ugly out there today, I must say. So before we dig into some of our content, we'll just run through some macro and metal prices. Big news was copper supply disruptions. We keep hearing about those. Yep. The strike at Escondida is coming. There's going to be
stormy weather. Shut down 4 or 5 copper shipping ports in northern Chile during beach season.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that happens, but wow.
And so we've seen copper rise. It was, I think it hit a peak of almost 270. Today it closed at about $2.66 per pound. Gold was trading at $1,229.40 per ounce at the time of recording. Silver was at $17.64. It closed today. And West Texas Intermediate oil was at $53 and roughly 14 cents per barrel. So relatively a flat day, actually. Not a lot of movement in most commodities. We have seen the copper bounce on that supply concerns, and people seem to be fast-forwarding their investment thesis on copper a little bit. You've been like the worst people about copper. They're like,
well, I think
like
Goldman Sachs might always be.
Yeah,
worst,
or Goldman Sachs. It's well, one of the
depends on where they're
culprits.
Long or short.
Yeah,
They think they need to move the commodities market. Yeah.
So, Mickey, let's get started with that then. I mean, you've been in Vancouver the last 4 weeks. You've been through, obviously, the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference, got kind of a feel for what's going on in the Canadian markets. What are some observations you have for us to start off?
Well, I think... copper's got a ways to go. It was up 17% last year. It lagged behind all the base metals, industrial metals, let's say. It was the laggard. And generally, when we come out of these bear markets for commodities, copper leads the way. It is, after all, Dr. Copper. So from that point of view, I think copper and uranium probably have the most upside this year, and we've seen that already in uranium, and copper's got a really nice bump going on so far. But we're still dealing with metal prices that are not that much off their historic lows. Copper was $4.44, about 4 years ago.
Yeah.
It's at $2.64 or $2.66 today.
Yeah.
And a lot of room for growth there, and I dare say in the copper market that most copper production in the world is just about break even at this price.
I'd say so.
So this supply disruption that you have during times of bear markets takes a while to recover from. The near-term supply disruptions become just opportunities for the market to take the next step up and establish a new base. So we've seen this very rapid rise from when Trump was elected, copper was $2.25.
Yeah.
You cannot discount the Trump effect on that, but we have supply-demand fundamental problems in the near to mid-term copper market because all these projects, Peru ramped up 50% over the last couple of years, but all these other copper expansion projects have gone on the shelf. That is not only supply disruption, that is supply destruction. And there's a big difference. So very bullish on copper going ahead.
Well, it's interesting. You make a couple really good points there, one of which is, if you look at the sort of at mine production costs for most of the copper operations worldwide, not many are breaking even. I'd say not many are breaking even at these prices even. I mean, there are a few, but by and large, a lot of them aren't, are doing that well.
A lot of the lowest quartile would be doing good.
Yeah, exactly.
But let's look where we are a year and 2 weeks ago at $1.96. Mm-hmm. No one was break even then. And I knew when it went below $2, I piped up right away and said, this is bottom. This cannot stay this way. And I don't know how long it stayed, but a day or two.
Yeah.
And it at least popped up to $2.04, $2.05. It went above $2 again.
Mm-hmm.
But, this is basic supply demand fundamentals in a capitalistic economy, and if people don't make money, production goes by the wayside, and the pendulum always swings too far one way or the other.
And exactly, it's segueing the second point you made that was a really good one, is we have gone through a period recently of widespread copper expansion, and you've seen a lot of large-scale projects go online in the last 5 to 10 years, things like Constancia, projects like that coming online.
Antamina.
And that's sort of ending now. Like you said, there's not a lot in terms of near-term horizon on what's going to be coming in the next wave of copper mines. And the other interesting point that we always talk about is that a lot of the analyst notes I see, the threshold to bring new copper operations online is over $3 a pound. In order to sort of incentivize people to start building what's there now, the poundage we know is in the ground, right?
Very well taken.
So, I mean, if they want to incentivize this new batch of copper operations, which are, let's face it, lower grade, probably harder to mine, they're going to need a higher copper price just to incentivize people to build them, right?
Yep.
So all those together is why you see a lot of people talking about over, let's say, a time horizon of 5 to 10 years, copper is a very sexy metal, if you will.
And it's always a sexy metal. Very seldom is copper not a relatively sexy metal, because, as I've alluded to before, it is Dr. Copper, and it is a forward-leading economic indicator in the short term of the health of the world's economy. Plus, once again, I came back to the same old thing. We got 85 million more people on the planet every year, and 25% of the world still gets up when it gets light, and they go to bed when it gets dark, and they sleep 12 hours a day, but they can't turn a light switch, and you cannot transmit copper.
Electricity
without copper.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's not used in those big power lines you see going across the hinterland. That's aluminum. But every transformer in the world has a load of copper in it.
And not to mention all those electric cars and cell phones.
Right.
And a variety of other green technologies that everyone loves.
Every time you use Google, there's signals being transmitted across copper.
Well, and the other thing before we get off copper that I find a little interesting is you haven't seen a lot of high-profile exploration plays over the last 5 to 10 years. You haven't seen a lot of big discovery holes, and you haven't seen a lot of people spending a significant amount of capital on exploration, because it is expensive, let's face that. But I mean, so now that you're looking at it, I mean, is there an opportunity for copper juniors? I mean, it is expensive.
Oh, absolutely.
But I mean, like, for people to raise that much money to start drilling for them again?
Absolutely. If there's one thing I am continually searching for, and there's very seldom when I'm not, is good startup copper projects, new copper projects, or copper projects. Number one, we got a lot of copper in the world, copper projects in the world, very few are high grade enough. And so the idea, for me, it's a smaller paradigm. I'm not going in looking for the big mega copper projects that are going to make 10 billion tons of porphyry copper and produce world-class copper deposits. There's a niche below that I operate in. And perhaps more in tune with a junior's capability. A junior going in a new porphyry copper project, your time frame to get where your only exit strategy becomes selling to a major copper producer, that time frame of exploration, advanced exploration to, say, a pre-feasibility study completed, is a minimum of 10 years. And that's much longer than the life of an average junior. So juniors that go into porphyry copper new projects don't generally have longevity to be successful in that.
And I think a lot of, like, the business model you're seeing now is that you need a strong partner, be it like Cordoba Minerals, for example, has Friedland and HPX funding a lot of that drilling. The Aston Bay had BHP, briefly had them, have now lost them. And you saw Northern Shield Resources had South 32. So you're seeing with these large base metal exploration programs that maybe you should look for a junior that has somebody sort of standing behind them with deeper pockets. Your dilution will
The average junior to put a... You know, there is one exit strategy if you take on a big porphyry copper exploration project, and that's sell to a major.
Yeah.
Very few management teams, geologic teams, have the savvy to do that. an example of somebody who did that would be Antares.
Yeah.
And,
right.
you know,
yeah.
and they're at it again with Regulus.
With
those
Regulus,
guys.
Yeah.
But those, the guy that runs those two companies, John Black, had lots of experience with majors. He's got lots of contacts with majors. But ultimately, your only exit strategy is sell to a major. And I like junior companies that have multiple exit strategies, or can have them.
Exactly, yeah, and that's something you always hammer on the show, is that you need multiple exit strategies. And so, to finish up on copper, Mickey, I mean, is there any sort of areas or jurisdictions that have you're looking at now, or is it still sort of early?
Very early. Yeah. I have a hard time finding projects that merit my attention, but I think maybe, I've certainly mentioned this before, I'm trying to do a copper oxide deal in Zambia
right now.
And whether we get that pulled off, you never know. Let's look at it this way. Yeah. The copper belt of Zambia and the DRC
is the
most endowed copper province in the world. They are the highest grade. They've got cobalt to go along with them. So the world's best copper deposit from a geological point of view are in the copper belt of southern Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Unfortunately, the geopolitics, especially the DRC, it's a tough road to hoe, ask Friedland and Freeport and First Quantum about all this sort of stuff and all the predecessor companies that come before.
Yeah.
Zambia across the border hosts the majority of copper belt copper deposits. And to me, it's a little bit more geopolitically palatable,
stabler than the
DRC.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah. And it's interesting.
But it is Southern Africa, and there's a geopolitical risk there that does not occur in the Americas. That said, they do have the world's best copper deposits. About Trilogy Metals.
And
the Ambler District, and
yeah,
that's pretty attractive.
Palatable.
Alaska's always been geopolitically palatable to me, with the exception of Northern Dynasty, who are opposed by a native corporation. And, you know, you look at Ex Nova Copper, now Trilogy Metals, the Nana Corporation's right on board for that. So, you know, with the Trump administration, certainly the Northern Dynasty Pebble Project has rid itself of some unreasonable and basically illegal
opposition
done by the EPA, which even the Washington Post writes an editorial about how this is going to change now because the EPA operated out of its realm and basically did something that violates U.S. laws and regulations. That said, I will go on record to say this, that Northern Dynasty, at present metal prices and even at elevated copper prices, with its CapEx, is demonstrably uneconomic from even their own feasibility studies.
Yeah.
And in my very strong opinion, and I've said this before, they should focus on East Pebble.
Yeah, no,
and
that's
not
a good
on the
point.
Big open pit. Let's go and take a look at the economics of working east of the fault in a relatively deep but extremely high-grade copper gold deposit at East Pebble.
Look at the bulk tonnage underground, maybe, or
something
like that.
Absolutely, man.
Yeah, you're with Mickey. We have talked a lot about macro, but I wanted to let Leslie get to the geology corner this week because you guys are going to talk about some really cool stuff, mainly Finland and some geology around Scandinavia, which Canadian investors might not be too familiar with. There's not a lot of Canadian juniors active up there. So I will kick it over to Leslie, and she can jump into the geology corner.
Geology corner, special edition.
Yeah.
Mickey Volpe. Himself. No, there's a lot of talk in the town right now about Orion Resources, especially in Vancouver. I hear a lot of people just talking about their latest.
I think it's called Orion.
Orion.
At least that's the way we good Americans.
You even wrote it down there.
Orion. A U R I O N. Orion.
Or onion if you're dyslexic. So anyway, so I thought that maybe this geology corner I'd kind of kick off with a bit of a brief overview of who the main players are and what the geology is and what's going on, and then I'm just going to pass it over to Mickey So let me know about some of the companies he has his eyes on, because he's been following the Finland story for a while now. So
for quite a while, yeah.
Yeah, totally. All right, so just to kick it off, you know, we are in the Fennoscandian Shield. It's a big chunk of Archean and Proterozoic rocks that covers most of, well, pretty much all of Finland, Switzerland, and northwestern part of Russia. And it's actually the most important metal district in Europe, which is pretty cool. So the shield was historically known for its VMS and magmatic nickel, copper, and PGE deposits, and a whole bunch of others. But interestingly enough, it was a super late bloomer in the gold space. Before the 1980s, it had really few gold occurrences, right? With the most significant probably being the Boliden deposit, which is actually a super gold-rich VMS deposit, which graded 8.3 million tons at 15.9 grams gold. So super high grade.
Obviously one of the highest grade VMS deposits in the world.
Totally. Yeah. And interestingly enough, when I was doing some research on Boliden ages ago, some ideas is that the gold was introduced during like later fracturing and faulting by later fluids. But anyway, all that aside, may I digress. Since the 1980s, the number of gold occurrences has clearly grown, at least in Finland. They have now 5 producing gold mines, the largest producer being Agnico Eagle's Kittilä mine in the central Lapland greenstone belt in the north. It has 4.4 million ounces of gold, and even more so in like inferred and indicated resources. That's just reserves alone. And so the mine produced in 2015 a total of 120,000 ounces. Now, aside from Agnico Eagle, who's doing a lot of exploring in Finland, we see a lot of junior explorers working in the region. In Finland specifically, we have Mawson Resources, we have Orion Resources, and their partner B2 Gold, and they have a big land package as well. And you have Dragon Mining and Nordic Mines, but those two don't trade on the TSX. And of course in Sweden, which we won't get into today, we have Eurasian Minerals and Tasman Metals and all that sort of stuff. So capsule geology, here we go. This is really interesting. Maybe a lot of people don't really know this, but the most prospective belts in Finland are the eastern, or in the east and up in the north with the Lapland Greenstone Belt. And the cool thing is that it's basically the same type of geology as the Archean Canadian Shield in Canada. Okay, so that's the shield, that's the rocks in Canada that host the prolific greenstone belts in Ontario and Quebec. Now, interestingly, the age of mineralization between Canada and what we see in Finland are different, with the main pulses of gold in Canada occurring around 2.7, 2.9 billion years ago, whereas in the Fennoscandian Shield, it was introduced 1.8 billion years ago in the Proterozoic. So, and it happened when, during an orogenic event, so mountain building, when outboard volcanic terrains collided onto the Archean margin of ancestral Finland. Now, that sounds kind of like BC, if anybody is nerdy enough to follow me in my geological journey through Canada. But all that aside, I'm just going to pass it over to Mickey to kind of let us know what the state is of exploration in Finland right now. What are some challenges? Who should we be keeping some eyes on? And what the potential there is? So Mickey, what do you reckon?
So this is a greenstone terrain of whatever age. Now, in this case, it's very earliest Proterozoic, which if you go and look, many of the world's largest gold districts are of this age.
Totally. Okay? Yep. It was a really fun time in Earth's history. There was so much gold kicking around. It was crazy.
Yeah, right. So
it's like gold volcanoes.
So it's historically underexplored because it's under shallow glacial till, but I'm emphasizing shallow glacial till, like on average, maybe a meter or two. So it's just this thin veneer of glacial till. So over the last 6 or 7 years, starting with Mawson Resources, Areva goes in, and it's been flown for radiometrics, and there's lots of radiometric anomalies in northern Finland. So Areva sticks is big ground, and they send their prospector geologists walking around with scintillometers.
Looking for uranium.
Yeah, looking for uranium in this shallow glacial till. It's kind of like typical Canadian boreal forest with fens and mires and swamps and muskeg and, you know, halfway underwater and stunted trees. And so they walk around and they see all these high-grade scintillometer anomalies. They carry scintillometers, strap them on their shoulder and sling them off about mid-calf level and go tromping around, and you get a buzz and you start digging, all right? And lo and behold, they dig up these samples, and there's bonanza grade gold embedded in essentially massive uraninite.
What?
So that was the discovery. So with Mawson, this big land package with multiple occurrences and multiple gold discoveries that have now been drilled or are being drilled right now, this uranium play became a gold play, and Riva doesn't want to be in gold, so they sold it to Mawson, and that happened in late 2010.
Right.
So Mawson has progressed there, and most in this terrain, big land packages, so quite a ways further north. Mawson's ground is near Rovaniemi, which is right on the Arctic Circle, near Santa Claus Land. We've all heard about Santa Claus Land. You know, I go fly into Rovaniemi and I go to Santa Claus Land, you know. Got to go to Santa Claus Land and pick up a few gifts for the girlfriend and the family and et cetera. But it's that part of the world. But it's very moderated climate compared to what we would think of the Arctic Circle in North America, because you've got this big Gulf stream and up into the Baltic Sea and the Gulf of Finland, et cetera. So they actually have farms and highways, and they raise cattle up there above the Arctic Circle. So it's not as harsh. I mean, it's harsh in the winter. It's cold in the winter. But it's not up in the tundra like the Arctic Circle is in most of North America.
Interesting.
So most recently, another company, Orion Resources, and I should mention right now, I'm a shareholder of both these companies, Mawson and Orion, and Mawson pays as a sponsor of my website recently. So I cover that company. But most recently, Orion, say about 2014, acquired some past drilled projects, little things where they had some high grade over a few meters, interesting, but little bits of ground. Not recently, but sometime within the last year or so, they brought in B2 Gold as a partner on a significant portion of this ground. Then they staked massive amounts of ground quite a ways north up in Lapland, maybe 150 kilometers north of Mawson's occurrence. And lo and behold, this week they announced high-grade
grab samples
of quartz tourmaline fuchsite, which is the chromium-bearing green mica, high-grade grab samples for the most part, and gold, visible gold all over the place.
Yeah, I think specifically it was like 1.1 kilometer by 750 meters, and they've got like... They collected 113 samples. I'm doing this all by memory, by the way.
No, you're
and
right.
About
I remember 113.
40 samples graded more than 30 grams per ton. And
right.
This is grab samples at surface. And their stock really responded to
that. Oh, yeah. The stock went from 40 cents before the announcement, and they did a private placement yesterday, $6 million at $1.50. So ultimately, I think, if memory serves, it hit $1.93 the other day. So that's almost a five-bagger in less than a week on huge volumes. And this is on grab samples.
Yeah.
These aren't drill results.
Yeah.
For the most part,
yeah.
They're not outcrop samples. They're angular boulders in the shallow till, which implies they've not undergone lots of transport. They may be essentially in place. But now we have our second major grassroots gold discovery in northern Finland in relatively unexplored terrains. And this is extremely encouraging to me, Leslie, because the problem with our previous boom from 2003 to 2011, no one did grassroots gold exploration. Here's two companies now that look like they perhaps have made or potentially major discoveries in unexplored terrains. Because, recycling old mines and old projects, which is what we did from 2003 to 2013, didn't work. It did not find, with this exception, Fruta del Norte, did not find new world-class gold discoveries. So this, maybe the tide's turning and this boom, this incipient bull market we see coming, and the fact that people, that companies will value, speculators will value this grassroots exploration play in new terrains and underexplored terrains and covered terrains with all the best geologists and geophysicists using everything they can. With Mawson right now, it's all about basal till sampling undercover to try to figure out where these gold occurrences, because you have no outcrop, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm extremely encouraged by this whole set of affairs that maybe investors will start valuing grassroots exploration plays again, because that's the future of our business. So I should also put a disclaimer, not a disclaimer, but a caveat on this, and the environmental difficulties of operating in Finland for Mawson basically put them on more or less a four-year hold in their ability to advance their project. That's been cleaned up now, but it is not the easiest place to work in the world from an environmental point of view.
Really? Because it made the...
And it always scores best in the Fraser Institute.
It's number three in the Fraser Institute.
And so Mawson's done a lot of work, and it's changing. There was an election sometime within the last year, and administration's changed, so much more favorable to development. But it's not been without growing pains that Mawson has kind of paved the way for other companies in Finland at this stage.
What are the main environmental concerns that they have? Do they kind of enforce dry stack tailings or anything specific that... crazy caribou herds.
There's reindeer.
For a period of time when they elected a socialist government, the environmental department was controlled by some radical NGOs. That has changed. I mean, at one time you had the environment department at odds with the mining and engineering departments in the Finnish central government. So things have certainly improved from that point of view.
Sounds like the U.S.
The analogy could be made. It's the difference between an Obama administration and political appointees, and what we will have going forward for at least the next 3 years and 11 and a half months, which is a very environmentally friendly, regulation friendly federal government that will make America great again, which is very good for our business. Look at copper, look at zinc, all these metals. Infrastructure build out in the U.S. Is going to be absolutely wonderful for our business.
Great.
So I'm sorry I hijacked the geology corner. Was there more geology?
This is the sharing circle.
Was there more geology though?
No, that's pretty much covers everything. And if any of our listeners are wondering anything else, they can always get in touch with me.
Is there going to be a Finland piece in the paper now as well?
I don't know, because you know how I'm doing like marching across Canada and doing all the different geological districts?
Yeah.
I kind of really want to like just step out and do do a Finland district. So anyway,
well, you're going to try to talk to Orion.
TBA. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll try to get.
They don't know this yet, but Orion, I'll be calling you.
Yeah. Yeah. We're.
Well, you're a newfie like you are.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you
sure.
Know,
you know. Right?
So you ought to
calm down Torbay Road.
Yeah. No, I'm sure we'll get that in the paper soon. We'll get because we want to cover that, so we will get them on the line. So
I would say watch out for Mawson. Mawson's going to have first drill results before PDAC.
Great.
Diamond drill results. They put out press release of some of their basal till sampling today. It's very encouraging. So it's tough terrain because you're walking in the mire, you know. Like when I was last in Finland, we're walking on planks, these 1x6 planks. You're walking and trying to not slip off, and it was like icy. So you're walking in your knee-high muck boots and on icy wooden planks in the mire. You know, the planks, but there's a every once in a while somebody would slip and fall, or one time one foot slipped off and I'm a foot deep in the mire and sinking slowly down in the bog.
At least there wasn't a Vanderstand.
And I had to throw the other foot off on the other side of the 6-inch plank, and it goes a foot down, and I'm about 4 inches off the top of my muck boots, and I got the CEO of Mawson Resources is trying to pull me up, braced,
really?
As he's standing on this icy 6-inch board. And luckily, we both made it out without getting our feet wet.
There
so that's
go.
Pretty good.
That's
but
pretty good.
I keep bugging him to do an odds and saws, but he hasn't done one yet. But we're going to get one of your odds
yeah,
and saws in for
got,
sure. He's got like 100 of them every
oh,
time
constantly.
I talk to him.
Yeah.
This has been the Northern Miner Podcast. And once again, I would like to thank Mickey Fulp, the mercenary geologist,
my
for joining
pleasure.
Us. So Mickey, if you would just want to give a quick pitch on where people can find you.
Yeah, mercenarygeologist.com. 6,400 subscribers, it's free. So if you sign up, you get my stock picks immediately. At Mercenary Geo, we are now well over 60,000 Twitter followers, very active on Twitter. And this interview, as all my interviews, go in the rotation at mercenarygeologist.fm, 24/7 streaming audio. You can listen to me 24/7.
It's perfect.
If anybody would ever choose to do that. But we reach somewhere about 35 countries on a monthly basis.
Wow.
Lots of listeners. They probably put it on and just let it run and listen for a while. So,
if you want to listen to the dulcet tones of Mickey Fulp 24 hours a day, you can indeed do that. But this is Matthew Kiwa. We are on location in downtown Vancouver. This is the Northern Miner Podcast with
Leslie Stokes.
And we would like to thank you for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
Ciao, everyone.